This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, Australia's donation of dozens of assault rifles to Solomon Islands comes under scrutiny.
But the problem is the announcement yesterday was somewhat tone deaf because, you know, in the Solomon Islands civil conflict, arms and the use of arms was a major problem.
Also ahead, a new Pacific Climate Change Mitigation Centre is in the works and hopes to bring private stakeholders to the table.
The centre will focus on business and economics of the climate change space.
And you might know of Tonga's skills on the rugby field, but do you know their robotics team are also international title holders? We'll hear from a Tongan student whose team won silver at a global robotics competition. All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Thanks so much for your company. First, though, to Solomon Islands, where an Australian donation of 60 assault rifles and police vehicles is raising eyebrows. It comes 9 months after police received replica rifles from China, with many expecting Beijing to follow through with real weapons. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare says the donations show the depth of his country's relations with Australia.
These supports are a necessary support to the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force operations. This assistance will help strengthen our country to protect and serve our people and ensuring security, peace and stability in the country. Therefore, I wish to stress on the outset my deepest appreciation to the government and people of Australia for your continued support.
But Solomon Islands opposition leader has labelled the gift of guns as disturbing. Matthew Wale says Australia is being driven by anxiety over China's growing police cooperation with Solomon Islands. But Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, has defended the donation, calling it responsible.
This was a long-running, long-standing commitment to provide a small number of firearms and I think about 12 vehicles, somewhere between 10 and 20 vehicles, to really equip a mobile unit for the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force to protect critical infrastructure. This is part of our support for Solomon Islands. We're proud to be the security partner of choice for the Solomon Islands, and we obviously aspire to be the security partner of choice for all members of the Pacific family, and this was a long-standing commitment that we're very proud to deliver. It complements what we're doing with our Guardian class patrol boats for both countries like PNG and the Solomon Islands. We're really committed to a secure and stable Pacific. It's in our interest, it's in the Pacific's interest.
You mentioned being the security partner of choice. So is this about genuine operational needs of Solomon Islands, or is this about China stepping up its engagement with their police force?
Well, without getting into sort of operational theory about how they're going to deploy the unit, I'm advised that it's to support and protect critical infrastructure. I think if you saw the unrest last year in the Solomon Islands, it's important that the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force has the equipment and the capability that is needed. And the Solomon Islands Assistance Force, SIAF, is a critical part of that. The AFP is doing lots of work training the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force. I had a great meeting with Police Minister Vecchi in Canberra last week, where he was visiting the AFP training facilities to get a greater understanding of how we can partner together. So we're proud of our role supporting a secure and stable Pacific, including in the Solomon Islands, and these announcements are part of that. Our commitment to the Pacific goes back decades. It's not about what other countries might be doing in the last couple of years.
There have been some concerns on that from residents. We've already seen coming out that, you know, perhaps these guns particularly, the risk of them being stolen or used by criminals. Are you confident, I guess, around the training that's being provided and that this is a responsible donation?
Well, part of the package is very significant and comprehensive training by the Australian Federal Police before these weapons were issued and provided and the vehicles. So that training element is very strong, and that training element is there to give support. And look, I got to meet some of the excellent policemen and women of the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force when I was there in late August, early September. And I was very impressed with their professionalism. And I was equally impressed by the cooperation they have and the work they do with the Australian Federal Police, but also the broader SIAF, including PNG, Fiji, New Zealand. So it's a story where we're working together to build capacity and capability.
That was Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, speaking with our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting. But a low level of trust between Solomon Islands police and its people might mean Australia's firearm donations are not so welcome by the public. Dr. Anouk Ride is a Solomon Islands researcher affiliated with the Initiative for Peacebuilding at the University of Melbourne. I spoke to her a short time ago. So Dr. Ride, we've had Australia's Minister Conroy call these donations of firearms to Solomon Islands as responsible. What are your thoughts on it? Do you believe it is?
Well, look, on one hand, this was always a planned move that Australia would help the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force to arm themselves. And these officers that will be using the arms will have training, not in just in the weapons use, but in sort of stages of escalation, you know, in what context, you know, these arms should be used. But the problem is the announcement yesterday was somewhat tone deaf because, you know, in the Solomon Islands civil conflict, arms and the use of arms was a major problem. Many people had, you know, guns pointed in their faces. They were threatened with arms. And of course, a few hundred people lost their lives. So when you have, you know, all of a sudden images of the Solomon Islands police giving arms without any real context as to why and how these arms are going to be used, it creates fear and mistrust. And the other sort of problem that we have in the Solomon Islands is that trust in the police force is low. This has come through in several studies and, you know, just through interacting with people and trying to encourage the reporting of crimes. I found it myself. Like, trust in the police services, the police officers is low. So when you have low levels of trust and a population that's been previously experienced trauma and loss of lives, you know, with these kind of weapons, whether this move is a good idea is debatable.
I mean, what does that trust come down to? As you mentioned, this history of armed police actually contributed to the conflict we saw. I understand that the police weapons themselves were used to overthrow the government. Is that some of the fears that the public is expressing with these donations?
So looking at the public response yesterday, there's two concerns. I mean, guns are basically used to kill people and to threaten people. You know, that image of threat, you know, I could shoot you if I wanted. Now, the image of threat, you know, in what context is that going to be used? It would be understandable if it was used in a context of border security, for example, where police are facing sometimes criminal gangs that, you know, may have arms on board ships. But it would not be understandable to use these kind of arms in situations of protests or riots. And this is really one of the key concerns, because if we look across the border to Papua New Guinea, several people have been killed by police firing into crowds, either protests or later on riots. So this is the fear, you know, will these weapons actually be used in a context of, you know, just a crowd of people and people are innocent people are shot for no reason? And then the second problem is this storage of the arms and whether the police force can be trusted to store and keep these arms out of the hands of others. So what happened during the tensions is that the armory was raided by militants, and, you know, they, from after that, the violence escalated significantly because the militants had access to all these, you know, weapons that were capable of doing many, many things. So, you know, are we totally confident that that couldn't happen again?
I mean, Australia has said that the donation of the firearms is and the vehicles as well is to help police protect critical infrastructure, particularly during in unrest. Minister Conroy pointed to the riots that we saw last year, in fact, when he was defending the donations. Do you believe these firearms are needed to protect places and indeed people in the Solomon Islands?
I think if you look back at the history of how Solomon Islands has dealt with conflicts in the past, the remarkable thing about it is that most conflicts have been dealt with through negotiation by police and by others, rather than a sheer display of force. So, for example, in the city in Honiara, we have a community policing program where the police and community leaders sort of work together to cut down crime in communities and try and encourage people not to participate in crime. These are the sort of options that should be used, preferably over, sheer displays of force and arms, because we know that, arms themselves have risks. Even the best trained officers in the world, have incidences where they shoot people that, are innocent and should not, die at the hands of a gun. So we want the ideal scenario is that these arms that were donated yesterday are either never used or used, extremely rarely. The problem will be is if you just concentrate on equipment and training about the equipment without looking at how do you prevent conflict, how do you stop people from, riots, for example, from escalating, then you're really going to an extreme version of response rather than looking at, how we can respond in a way that doesn't involve arms and can actually create more peaceful cities.
Mm. Now, there has been talk that Australia is simply trying to outdo China with this donation. I mean, China was expected to make its own arms deal and donation with Solomon Islands. Does that context raise concerns to you at all, Dr. Reid?
So myself and colleagues at the Initiative for Peace Building at the University of Melbourne have written about the fact that China and Australia are both looking to influence Solomon Islands political leaders and influence the police force, but they're not. A better option would be to look at the effectiveness of the police force, and looking at means where the police force can stand on its own two feet. It's effective, it's transparent, and it has the trust of the people. What we have now is many, allegations and instances of corruption in the police force. To make a complaint about a police officer is a long and complicated process that's very risky too for people. They can't have necessarily anonymity and, witness protection. All of those things aren't options. So if you do complain against a police officer, you're taking on a significant personal security risk. And then the other thing is trust in the police force. So people want to see a police force that's effective, that's responding to threats around it. So, for example, in Honiara, if you walk a few metres from the police headquarters, you will see organised prostitution going on. You will see gambling and sale of illegal drugs, such as marijuana and sort of homebrewed alcohol. So if people saw a police force that was responding to these threats and actually cutting down on the crime that is influencing their lives, then that would increase trust much more than, just a display of force.
Mm. I mean, considering that context, I mean, you did say that you hope and ideally these guns will be used rarely, if at all. Do you think the fears that these guns could be used on Solomon Island's own citizens is a reasonable one?
It's hard to say at the moment. These weapons have just been supplied. And as I said, they have been done in a context of training on stages of escalation and how to use these weapons. I think, it would be desirable now that we focus on responding to crime. So, what would be great is if the AFP and the RSIPF work together on, for example, Operation Copen. Copen is a drug that's home-cooked and being supplied to schools all around Honiara. And it's a dangerous drug that's affecting even primary school children. Operation Copen, let's solve that problem. Operation No Child Prostitution, let's solve that problem. Operation, just search for illegal weapons in logging camps and other places, let's solve that problem. I think really a problem-solving approach is needed at this point if the AFP and the Solomon Islands Police Force are going to be trusted and people will have confidence in them again.
That was a Dr. Anouk Reid speaking to me a short time ago. You're listening to Pacific Beat. Hope you're having a lovely Thursday morning. Coming up very shortly, we'll be taking a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific region. But first, In just a few days' time, the 27th United Nations Conference of Parties on Climate Change will open in Egypt. The first COP was held in 1995, and one of the attendees then was Rex Horoy. He was acting as a spokesperson for the Alliance of Small Island States. Now, though, the Solomon Islander has been appointed as special envoy on climate change by Melbourne's Monash University, who are also partnering with Fiji National University on a new climate change mitigation centre. As he told reporter Nick Fogarty, he'll be working with the centre to connect international, regional and national conversations on how to finance the fight.
The centre then is a centre for research for the Pacific countries, kicking it off with the relationship between Monash and Fiji National University, supported by the Fiji government. So operationally, the centre will focus on business and economics of the climate change space to collect the data that is out there, since everyone is been talking about climate change and it's been lots of stakeholders are working on climate change, trying to define a niche for themselves. But we do not know in the Pacific region who is doing what, where, how. So this is key to try and establish that database that everybody can share. And the focus will be policymakers and the development partners that are operating throughout the Pacific regarding climate change.
And I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that I am a Monash law student.
Yes.
But the envoy role is embedded in the Monash Business School. But given that business essentially exists to return profits to shareholders, how do we involve business in that fight against climate change without compromising, you know, on what needs to be done science-wise?
Yes. Of course, the climate lawyers, business lawyers and environmental lawyers need the part between them and amongst them rather than fighting each other to see whether profits compromise environmental protection and environmental, if we're going to turn from fossil fuel to carbon-based circular economy that is based on the level of emissions that we are transmitting. So to get business involved, we need the research in order to convince business CEOs and those that are running small-sized business to ensure that there is a combination of environmental lawyers, business lawyers, climate lawyers to actually come up with sensible compromises that will benefit all partners rather than just one partner having one size fits all.
So COP27 is now happening in a few days in Egypt, but the narrative around it has been quite contested. So, for example, Greta Thunberg says it's greenwashing and world leaders like Rishi Sunak and Anthony Albanese won't or might not be attending, with the perception being that they don't think it's important enough. So what do you think of such greenwashing claims about COP27?
Well, that will go on. There is politics surrounding, there is geopolitics and there is national politics, regional politics surrounding the climate debate. Now, I don't want to get into that because I'm representing Monash, whose Impact 2030 demands climate change to be addressed while considering the thriving communities and the geopolitical security and the climate change space that Monash wants to promote. I will try and say that politicians or at the political level, there is a role they play. We need political will to drive finance and science going hand in hand to support action. So there is a debate. Now, there is also action needed, and therefore financing of climate initiatives in the Pacific is essential, and that is one of my key roles representing Monash.
That was Solomon Islands diplomat and now Monash University's special envoy on climate change, Rex Horoy, and he was speaking there to Nick Fogarty. Well, it is that time where we find out what the papers, what the broadcasters around the region are reporting this Thursday morning. And to do that, we are joined by reporter Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Now, we've been gearing up for this. Tomorrow, Vanuatu's parliament is expected to sit. It's the new parliament. The elected MPs will be sitting for the first time, we expect, and they could swear in and elect a new prime minister there by tomorrow. We might have a new prime minister of Vanuatu. So do we know who's in the running and what's the latest there?
Well, Ismail Kaukasau is pretty confident. So his camp says they've got the numbers needed to form government he's pretty confident that they'll name its PM and cabinet lineup by tomorrow. So we've obviously been reporting on these negotiations for some time. The latest reports say that Kaukasau has a coalition of 30 MPs in the 52-member upper house. That's in comparison to a second camp led by caretaker Prime Minister Bob Loughman, who only has 22 at this time.
Oh dear. So has Loughman made any comment yet trying to bolster bolster support?
It doesn't appear so, and no surprises there. The spokesperson for Kaukasau's group, Sato Kilman, has urged Loughman's camp to accept defeat and get ready to play his role in opposition. So definitely didn't mince his words there, but we'll see how it plays out.
Yes, very interesting. It's very hard to predict Vanuatu politics, so until it happens tomorrow, it's anyone's game. And is that being reported, did you say, in Vanuatu Daily Post?
That was on RNZ, actually. I got that one. Yeah, okay. I couldn't find it in the Daily Post today.
Okay, so we'll see what happens there in local news. But now let's head to Solomon Islands. We've been chatting a bit about politics there with the police being given those assault rifles by Australia. But a different story here with a politician's home being torched in the Solomon Islands. What's happened?
Yeah, so the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force have launched an investigation into an alleged arson incident which took place in Malaitia, Outer Island. So this is reported by the Solomon Islands Times, who say that a house belonging to a member of the Provincial Assembly was burnt to the ground.
Yes, Malaita. Whenever I think of Malaita, we think of its, plans, or urges for independence and criticism of Solomon Islands' relationship with China. But I understand it's a different situation that we're looking at here. Can you tell us more about why this torching happened?
So I understood, I mean, according to reports anyway, it was carried out by disgruntled villagers who lashed out at their local MPA over a lack of shipping services to the islands. And that's apparently led to low food and just low basic supplies in general. So police say they've got seven suspects into custody who have been transported to Honiara for questioning. Charges are expected to be laid, but police are still appealing for the community's help so they can gather more evidence.
Very interesting there. We'll see, I guess, if that torching made a difference. It's that, and if the people who were behind it are actually brought to justice. Now to some sports news. Cook Islands are playing their Women's World Cup opener. You know, I'm getting confused with all these rugby league sports stories going on. There's the Men's Rugby League World Cup that's happening in England. Now there's the Women's World Cup. Tell us more. How are Cook Islands going?
So just to clarify, this is the Women's Rugby League World Cup, which is also happening in England at the moment.
Okay, there you go.
But yeah, not to get it confused with the Rugby Union Women's World Cup, which I believe is happening in New Zealand at the moment as well. So,
oh, really?
Yes,
at the same time?
There's a lot going on at the moment in the sport of just rugby football in general.
Yes.
But no, the Cook Islands are on the field right now against Australia. Not going too well for them, unfortunately. The last time I checked the score, it was 36-0 in favour of Australia at halftime. Mm. They did draw the short straw in a couple of ways,
Australia
having to play Australia
strong.
Up first. Exactly. Mm. Everyone, you know, looks to make a statement in that first game of the tournament. That being said, though, you know, we'll see how they go in the second half.
And, but in some good news, I guess, the PNG women recorded their first World Cup win yesterday. How was that?
Yeah, this is a great story. So the Orchards are well and truly off to a flyer with a 34-12 win over Canada. Yeah, their first in history. 26 wow. points came in the second half. It was really close up until halftime. They only led 8-6. Martha Mulawai very much proving the difference, scoring a try either side of the break to lay the platform to victory.
Well, how exciting there. Some good news for women's sport. And let's see what that World Cup brings. Thanks, Carl, for those stories.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was Carl Evans bringing us the latest from around the Pacific. And coming up here on Pacific Beat, we'll be speaking to Tokelauan and Pacific, beloved Pacific musician Olivia Foai. She has a new song out, and it's actually bilingual. It's in English and in Tokelauan. We'll be speaking very shortly about that. But just around the corner, we'll be speaking all things robots, because a Tongan team has won silver at an international robotics competition. Do you have a question about what exactly a robotics competition involves? Well, so do I. So we'll find out very, very shortly after this very short break.
Love sport? Tune in to Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau.
The Australian government have announced that they will be supporting rugby union in Tonga, Samoa, Solomon Islands and Fiji. Think about Fiji, they've absolutely dominated on the world stage. And I'm like, do you guys really need the money?
Maybe they need to do like some exchange with Fijian coaches.
Now that's a thought.
Over here, like.
I love that.
Can You Be More Pacific? Thursday night, 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat. Hope you're having a fantastic Thursday morning. Five Tongan University students have won silver in a global robotics contest in Switzerland, impressing not only family and friends, but the country's prime minister as well. One of the University of South Pacific students enjoying the win is Uluwakiola Fine, who joins me now. Welcome to the program, Uluwakiola.
Thank you very much.
So tell us, how was it to be in Switzerland at this global robotics competition?
Well, it was a great experience, not only for me, but for my team. We got to visit Switzerland, interacted with many teenagers from other countries as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. I've got this question, though, for you, Uluwakiola. What is a robotics competition? What exactly were you competing? How were you competing?
So this year's challenge theme was carbon capture. So the robot's objective was to collect as much carbon as possible, which were balls dropped into the arena, 240 to be exact. So 240 balls that represented carbons would be released onto the arena, and the robots were to collect them and put them in a container that was in the middle of the field.
Wow. So how big are these balls, and how big are the robots?
So the robots were designed to be under 50-centimeter cube.
Okay, so quite small robots, and I assume the balls were smaller than them, at least let's hope. And were you the ones, were your teams and your teammates the ones who designed and built the robots?
Yes, so each of our teams had their own roles. My role was a programmer, so that's what I did. I programmed the robot.
Wow, so you program the computing that goes behind and tells the robots what to do. So tell us about the robot that Tonga entered into this international challenge.
So our robot, our strengths were that our robot was able to effectively collect the balls, store them, and we could actually shoot the balls into the container that was in the middle of the field. But one weakness of our robot was that it had to hang, but we could only park on the floor.
Oh, okay. So did it use wheels? That's why it could only park on the floor?
Yes. So there was different levels of hanging, whereas we could accumulate more points as we go higher. But our robot, we could only park on the floor.
Okay, so you couldn't, yours was in a climbing rear, but well, that still sounds impressive. I mean, shooting balls
yes.
into a container in the middle of a field sounds pretty great. And in fact, you know, the competition agreed or the judges agreed, you've secured second place, your team, Tonga, in this robotics challenge. What was that like, getting second in this competition?
Well, when we first started preparing for the competition, we weren't aiming for medals or awards. We're just doing our best and everything we can so that we can represent Tonga. Well, it might be just a silver medal, but for us, it's much more than we expected. For Tonga, a small dot in the Pacific, winning silver in the international competition.
Yes, I mean, I wanted to ask how you got into robotics and computing. Like you said, you programmed the robot. Is it very a popular thing to do in Tonga? How did you find yourself in this space?
Well, for me, I grew up in an environment where my father would always work on robotics. So that's how I developed the interest in this area. So it's not really developed in Tonga, but it was always one of my interests to always practice on coding and programming.
Yes, and now it's taken you to Switzerland, and I understand that on your return to Tonga, you met up with the Prime Minister, who invited you and your teammates to lunch after your win in the competition. What was that like?
Well, he was very proud of what we have accomplished. For Tonga to accomplish silver in a field that was very poorly developed in Tonga, he was very proud and he was very happy representing the government in thanking us of the achievement we have made.
Yes, and where to from here? You've won second place, Ulwakiola, at this international competition. What are you going to do after this? Do you see you going into more robotics, more competitions?
Well, for me, I will continue on my studies with computer science in software engineering, but I will always be here in helping the future teams of Tonga that will be representing us in the first global challenge, because it will go on for many more years.
Okay, yes, building more. You have no plans to build an army of robots, perhaps, that shoot balls wherever you want? That is my fear of a robot takeover. I hope you won't be behind it.
Well, for now, we're just going to be helping the next teams, and then we'll see on expanding this field here in Tonga.
Yes, yes, indeed. And interesting that carbon capture was about this competition. I mean, can robots be used to help us fight climate change, do you think?
Yes, they can be very useful in doing things that us humans cannot do.
Okay, so maybe not just for competitions, but we might see them in the real world as well.
Yes.
Ulwakiola, all the best for your future and congratulations again for this amazing win.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I would like to thank the Almighty for blessing us with this knowledge and talent, and to everyone he blessed us through. We couldn't have done it without the country's support and everyone else.
Oh, wonderful. Hopefully more to come. Thank you so much for joining us here on Pacific Beat. That was Ulwakiola Fine. He is a University of South Pacific student, but has also won silver along with his teammates in a global robotics contest in Switzerland. And thanks to that, also met up with the country's prime minister there.
Said there's too much darkness, said we need light in this life. I need good energy and vibe.
Are you an up-and-coming Pacific artist? Pacific Break, the Pacific's biggest music competition, is back. Send us your original track and you could win an all-expenses-paid trip to perform at Warm Adelaide, Australia's biggest international music festival. Visit abc.net.au/Pacific Break to find out how to enter. Entries are open until November 27.
Yeah. You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. This is Priyanka Srinivasan. That is my name, Priyanka Srinivasan. Thank you for joining me this Thursday morning. And have I got a treat for you? Olivia Fowai's voice is synonymous with joy, from the soundtrack of the Disney film Moana to leading the vocals of multi-award-winning band Te Waka. And on a dark and rainy day in the middle of COVID-19 lockdowns, Olivia penned perhaps her most joyous song. It's called Sunlight, and it's a bilingual track that incorporates Tokelauan in the lyrics. Let's take a listen. Oh, with just that little sample, I hope you're all tapping your feet like I am to that. And to hear all about that new track is Olivia Fowai herself. Good morning to you, Olivia.
Maloney, good morning. How are you doing, Priyanka?
Yes, very well. And it was just, a very joyous track. How does this song explore? I mean, it's called Sunlight. One of the lyrics in the song, in fact, is sometimes we think depth lies in sadness. Oh, actually, you said this about the song. Sometimes we think depth lies in sadness and hurt, but I think joy is incredibly profound. How did this track try and explore that joy?
That's an interesting question. I think I'm still figuring it out exactly how joy is profound, but it just feels to me like something to celebrate and look into and, be a lot more interested in than sometimes, the darker side of things. There is actually, there's good weight in looking into how deep joy can be, and even maintaining your own joy and your own peace when there's chaos and perhaps darkness or sadness around you, or letting those two things coexist.
Yes, because as I just mentioned, you wrote this during the COVID-19 lockdowns. Was that part of that, being in such a, I imagine, difficult space? At least I felt it quite difficult to have your mind on joy and more happier times?
Yeah, it definitely changed the way that I looked at joy. And it was almost like it was a warmth coming from inside rather than, whatever I priorly conceived it to be.
Yeah, that's a very zen way of looking at things.
Lockdown made us so zen.
I know. We like to think so. Hopefully we clutch onto that bit. I mean, that's what I loved about your song, because it sort of starts, and we will hopefully have time to take a listen to it later, but it starts with actually being quite dark and then opens up into your lovely voice. Was that intentional? Did you have this thought of actually trying? I mean, it felt to me like a sun coming out from the darkness. Was that your intent?
Well, that's all my brother. I got to give credit to my brother Matatia Fawai. He produced that song. So that's what I love about it, is we're so similar. We grew up with a very similar upbringing. And so to me, the song meant one thing, and it was a lot of, it sounded very joyful and like a child when I sang it, when I gave him the demo. And then he did his own interpretation on it, and that you can hear in the instruments. So yeah, that's all him.
Yeah, it's a lovely thing about music, is that everyone can have their own sort of input and interpretation of it. Have you heard from fans? Have you heard from music lovers? What has their response been to the song?
I have had some nice response so far. I think people do like the joy of it. It's got a kind of an innocence about it, and kind of exudes this gratitude for life, which was the intention. So I'm really happy it's being received like that.
And now another very interesting part of this song is that you've incorporated Tokelauan into the song as well. Is that new for you? Do you speak the language? Were you raised speaking the language and singing the language as well?
So I was raised singing in Ngangana Tokelau and also in Samoan and Tuvaluan. From a very young age, I was always singing in the languages, but then I would go home and speak English. It was always English. So really getting into the language has been in recent years for me, but I've been writing in Ngangana Tokelau for like 2 years now. So it's a unique kind of journey when you grow up so loving a language and singing in it, but not actually speaking it at home. So I'm kind of trying to get more and more of that into my day-to-day.
Yeah, I can really relate to that as well because my parents speak a different language, but I was born here and speaking English, and it can be hard as an adult to go back and try and recover that language. How have you been doing that?
So with Ngangarato Ke Lao, it's not as big a language as other Pacific languages. You know, we've only just had our first course that I know of, that I've witnessed in New Zealand. I wasn't allowed to attend because I live in Australia. But I've collected some books from, you know, family members, some of the few books that we have. We have like these weekly Zooms with family, and we just talk Ngangarato to each other. Try to incorporate it a little bit into the house, but my dad will always throw in some Samoan there and confuse us all.
That's not fair, Dad. Why is it important to you to incorporate Tokelauan, the language, into your songs?
That's a really good question, and I've been actually having a lot of conversations with people about this, because, you know, a language that I didn't grow up speaking, why am I so attached to it? There's some kind of passage to the past that I feel in the language, and I think there is kind of like a soul element there that English doesn't really fulfill for me. Connecting with the language is, yeah, I haven't really figured it out yet, but it's, you know, like a little portal to the past. Those are the words that were passed down, if you know what I mean. And the way that they're structured gives you a clue as to the people who came before you. And yeah, it feels better than any other language to write in, to me personally.
Yeah, that's beautiful. If you are just tuning in here on Pacific Beat, we're speaking to Olivia Afoai. We're talking about her new track called A Sunlight. It was written in the middle of COVID-19, but actually, as we've been chatting about, it has this joyous song and music and also the lyrics to it as well are just so joyous. And it does incorporate Tokelauan English. It is bilingual. Can you tell us what some of the lyrics, particularly in Tokelauan, mean in the song?
Yeah, of course. So that main part, is it a hook? I don't know. What's songwriting anymore?
You're the musician. You should be telling us.
So that part goes, Engaliote la, engaliote ahio, engaliote henua. So that's the sun is beautiful, the day is beautiful, the land is beautiful. To me, when I wrote it, I just felt like a kid running out into a field being like, everything is beautiful.
is that why you chose to sing those phrases in Tokelauan, to have that connection with your childhood?
Maybe. It wasn't a conscious thing. It's just I wrote the beginning in English, and then when it came to that part, it had to be Ngangarato Ke Lao, and I was actually in tears when I wrote that part. I don't know why. It's very confusing, but I think it was overwhelming, the feeling. And I guess also the simplicity of this idea that we have of how our ancestors lived, I think probably played a role, and just their appreciation for how beautiful nature, you know, the earth is. And so I think that probably played into it a little bit.
Yes, yeah. And tell me about the music video for the song as well. I haven't taken a look at it yet, but I understand your best friend is involved. Is that right?
Yes, she's my best friend. Her surname is confusing because she is married to my brother. But yeah, she is a beautiful dancer of the Tokelau Haatele. Interestingly, that's not a solo dance. So the Tokelau Haatele is always done together as a group. But the concept that I had for the video had to have her start in the dark and alone. And she really brought that to life in a way that I think moves me extra, because she's my best friend, and because, you know, to me she's the most beautiful dancer in the world. So
wow. So it was your idea for the music video as well. Was that hard, translating, you know, something, a song, music, into something visual?
No, I do it almost simultaneously, and my brother hates me for it because he won't have finished mixing and mastering a song and I'll already have like the script for the video written, and I'll be trying to organize it. And he's like, let me finish the song first. No, it's very simultaneous for me.
Wow, that's so interesting. Oh, I'll have to check out that music video. And what's next for you, Olivia? This song, I understand, is off your second album, but it's not released yet?
Yes, that's right. So next year will be my second album, and hopefully I'll do a couple more songs than last time. I think I only had 8 on my first. But yeah, just working on that. That's going to be quite a special project, hopefully, when it comes out.
Yeah, and do you plan to tour to be around singing when that album comes out?
Yes, I do plan to tour. I haven't quite got any great plans yet, but yes, once the album comes out, there will be shows.
Oh, that's exciting. We'll have to stay tuned to find out where they exactly are. Olivia, thank you so much for chatting to us. And actually, I would love for you to introduce this song, Sunlight, that we've been chatting about for the last 10 minutes. Do you mind just giving a few words, what people should listen out for the track, and then throwing to your own song, Sunlight?
Okay, I'll give it a go. First of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. This is my new song, Sunlight. It is in English, and I'm going to toke lao, and I hope that it brings you some sunlight in your day, and I hope that it blesses you on whatever journey you may be on.
When the sun rolls in to kiss my skin and remind me how good it's been.
What a wonderful track there. That was Olivia Foy with Sunlight. And I do hope the sun is shining wherever you are. At least I hope that song has allowed the sun to break through, at least if not physically, then at least emotionally. That was such a joyous track. And with that, it brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Hope you've enjoyed the show. If you want to catch up on anything that you've listened to, do head onto our website. Tomorrow, you'll be joined by Richard Hewitt, who will be bringing you a special sports version of this Pacific Beat program that you're listening to right now. Don't change your channel or anything. You can just stay tuned, same time, same place, and you'll get the latest in sports from around the Pacific. And we'll also be giving you an update if we do hear who Vanuatu's Prime Minister is. We're expecting that tomorrow. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia for all the latest there. Thank you for joining me this Thursday morning. I hope you have a lovely rest of the day.